You can often sense people's intention by the way they walk. I noticed that at the airport. I call it aimless feet. Have you seen people walking at the airport? They know they're not going anywhere. They're putting in time, and everybody at the airport walks the same way. Short little steps with the toes turned up and the feet turned slightly out. Just watch them. They're walking up and down, going nowhere. The plane doesn't leave for half an hour, and they don't want to sit anymore in rows with people they don't know, so they do the airport walk, toes up and feet turned outwards. And there are distracted feet. There's the distracted walk, people's heads into the cell phone, not even thinking of their feet at all. And then there are the driven feet, the driven walk. People with something on their minds. Everyone else may be cruising along at a regular speed, but you watch someone who is absolutely intense from getting from here to there, and you think this person has something on her mind. There are also falling in love feet. Have you seen that walk? People far more interested in what's going on in the eyes than what's going on among the socks at the bottom of the legs. And there are the proud feet. There's the shuffle we do in the spotlight when we're in the parade. Look at me, I finally made it to the float at the front. Now, we've passed a variety of people walking with different ways on their ways to church today, and they display what their owners think about God. Your God tells lies, say some of the feet we've passed, because they have been stepping through a world in which they find no sleep in heavenly peace. So you can talk about this in the text, and you can talk about this in the liturgy, but I'm not buying it, say the feet who tell us your God lies. There are others who are walking with feet that say your God plays favorites. You are all Christmas insiders bustling away through the snow or in the bright morning sunlight to a worship service at a church. But the rest of us feel left out and we're hanging out in the coffee shop or alone at home. Whatever the Christmas blessing is, it seems to have missed us. Others walk with your God is weak feet. Oh, I tried the God thing once a long time ago, but you know, I found it to be all wrapping and no gift. Lots of people like that out there. Others walk with feet that say your God is false. The world is a lot darker and more sinister and a lot more complex than the simple God you throw up to us Sunday mornings in the little prayers and the little hymns and the little movements. And others walk with their hands crossed and their arms folded and their feet intentional, and they're walking with feet called your God is too liberal. You in the liberal churches over there, far too much acceptance of the unacceptable. Too few standards for my taste, they say. And others walk with feet that say, your God is far too prudish, too thin like an old teacup from an antique store, unable to touch the calamities of the great unwashed and to help them. A variety of feet kicking up the snow and leaving marks. Well, the feet mentioned in 2 Isaiah's poem are called beautiful feet. They are feet that bring good news and announce the arrival of peace. And only people who are making a living out of bad news would ever worry about feet like that. Those feet walk to us with a message, and the message is, your God reigns. Isn't that a wonderful message to receive on a Christmas morning? Your God reigns? Beautiful feet. Now, does your God reigns mean that God controls everything, do you think? Have you found it so in life that God controls everything? Some churches have twisted that a little bit and made it sound pretty awful, and they turn to those outside the door and they say, God is calling all the shots. You people are just too thick to see it. Well, that goes over really big with the contemporary culture, doesn't it? And we find ourselves being left alone in our own little circles. I hope that we in this church would never say that to anyone. Perhaps we go a little broader and say, well, God holds all things together, no worries about that, but sometimes during transport, little bits and pieces get broken off. Well, that isn't too helpful either to hear when you've had a tragedy in your life or the wheels have fallen off your life or you're in a very sad place. Your God reigns. Could it mean that the one you most deeply sense is both active and present? It doesn't mean that we can command it, and it doesn't mean that we can even see it in every given moment, but somehow underneath it all, there's a backstop, and we sense it from time to time. We have one for whom you can thank the high and lovely moments you experience as really being there. The simple, seemingly odd story of our visitation and our rescue, that biblical gem, is actually true somewhere deep in down our experience. It will never desert us, and we're always safe in it. Now, during the Christmas season, the phrase, the reign of God, gets very particular. And it may be too particular for lots of people in the common culture. After all, with so many people riding on the bus, you have to be careful what you say if you want to keep your seat and if you want to keep the peace during the ride. But the author of the Hebrews points to a particularity which he finds to be absolutely true. The writer to the Hebrews was himself a liturgist. You can see by the way he handles the language. He was familiar with the sacred texts and rituals of Judaism, and he was in tune with the secular values and philosophies of Greek culture. He was the perfect person to speak and write into the public forum, much like John Kenneth Galbraith and John Ralston Saul. Now, as it happens, and this is just an aside, I met John Ralston Saul yesterday. Who would ever think that I'd meet John Ralston Saul? He and Adrian Clarkson, his wife, were having lunch in a Chinese restaurant where my family had gathered for my wife's birthday, and we noticed them come in, and our children were saying, should we go and ask for an autograph? Well, I don't know if you ask a former governor general for an autograph or not. So at the end of it, as I was walking by, I said to them, hello, are you enjoying your ribs? You have to say something to a former governor general. So we talked for a little while, and I said, I'm so pleased that I've run into you, sir, because I'm mentioning your name in a sermon tomorrow morning. You are someone who, to me, speaks to the public forum. He said, well, I'm very touched that you would do that and you would mention my name. Are you here with your family? I said, yes, it's my wife's birthday today. And he said, well, on behalf of Adrian and me, please wish her a happy birthday. And I said, well, my birthday's in November. He said, get lost. I imagine the writer of the letter to the Hebrews writing from the richness of some temple experience that he'd seen. He had experienced the colors and the odors and the fires and the songs and the stories and the fabrics and the vestments and the silence and the wonders. Perhaps he had even witnessed the high priest in all the shimmering robes that he wore, walking as the great pontifex, the bridge between the great God and the tribes, walking towards the Holy of Holies, that garbed place behind the curtains, purifying himself to face the power of unimaginable creativity. Can you imagine the stress and strain in that, purifying yourself to face the great creativity at the heart of the world? You know, I think that's what prayer is. Makes you think twice about it, doesn't it? The writer's opening phrases may well follow the steps of that high priest as he walked towards the Holy of Holies, the center of things. God may be speaking to us on other days, said the writer to the Hebrews, but on this particular day, God is speaking in a particular way. On this day, God is going to wipe the slate clean, and we will start again refreshed and new. The priest is a perfect example of God's call and of our response. And that priest is seen in the figure of Jesus Christ in the mind of the writer to the Hebrews. Behind the curtain, the priest in secret puts all his humanity before the creative power of God, brings all the humanity of the tribes before God, brings the soil and the glory of the year before God, and in a moment of profound grace has a sense that all is forgiven and a new start is being offered. And he pushes back the curtain and shouts to the expectant crowd, "Atonement is ours. We are one with the great God who calls us." What a moment. God has accepted them. And all are grateful that the balance between salvation and damnation has been tipped again in favor of salvation. It's a much more wonderful way to live. Your God reigns, then, is part of a rich temple theatrical production created to help us reach the deep places in us we can't reach any other way, to assure us of our worth and of our eternal belonging. Well, switch over to the prologue from the Gospel of John. It's very different. It was written nearly half a century later, to a different church in a very different era. It's no longer a question of simple evangelism in the church, where one person walking along the road, having felt the power of the story of Jesus in his life, tells another person about the power of the story of Jesus in his life. By this time, Jewish Christians have been expelled from the synagogues. The Jerusalem temple now lay in ruins by the hand of the Romans. And the question then out in the culture was, how deep and how broad is God's love for humanity? Is it just for us? Is it for us and them as long as they do it our way? Or is it for everyone? A question still contemporary in our world. To the people whom John wrote, "Your God reigns" meant keeping the rituals of the Jewish tradition while adopting a looser cultural conversation with the Greek world. Do all the right liturgical things, as we've always done them, but keep an ear on the culture and watch all the TV programming and follow the series on Netflix and read the newspaper and get involved in the discussions and have an opinion about politics, all the ways of being a contemporary person in a Greek and Roman world. These were sort of Sunday Anglicans in the theaters and lecture halls that we would see today. The simple idea of God being alive in a poor and rather messy life, working in the grit and muss of the daily grind, was far too mundane now, unlike the first days, and had become this liturgical moment with some theological thoughts and a lot of social sophistication. This was a far cry from the simple Galilean who turned to others and said, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." The conviction about Jesus had been told brightly and eagerly, evangelically, early in the mission, but now it has turned to something else. No longer was it a case of "this is what I have found" or "this is what I have experienced and it's so great in my life, I simply want to tell you what it means to me." It had now become theological speculation and a blue plate special and a buffet. You could take a little bit of this prayer and a little bit of this thought and build yourself a religious life. Very, very different. And we use the cultural buffet the same way these days in the liberal churches. We prefer contemporary expressions most of the time and easy listening most of the time. Most of us don't spend our hours poring through the scriptures to find out what the ancients had to say and what they meant. Well, we do a good deed because that's what you do. And you love your neighbor a little bit because you have to live next door to her. And you keep your nose fairly clean. It makes things better at home. And you guard your assets and your people, and you declare it to be a good life. It's sort of a generic life of faith, if you like. That's what the writer of John's Gospel was up against. This is the modern God reigns. It's often seen as a simple, good citizenship, common sense, and the milk of human kindness, but this was not the idea in John's Gospel at all. The writer of John's Gospel was not that broad. He was standing up for the earlier, more vigorous version, Jesus as somehow God in the flesh, in the street, in the mix. As intentional as that was John's message. He said, that the Word, that power which creates and sustains the world, that which belongs to all of us, has become singularly particular, the most particular it has ever come in the whole history of humanity. Brutal, beautiful, and clear as a bell in the figure of Jesus of Nazareth. Now that's pretty strident. It enlightens and it dispels darkness in the battle of life. It is real people standing up for real things against real threats, and in so doing, the revelation of God is made. That shakes up the social and cultural Anglicans in all of us. It involves far more than a simple nodding towards the idea of a deity. Now, we can all name the real John the Baptist and the real Jesus figures in our own lives who have walked the streets and touched us in our pain and turned us to the fact that the God is real and extremely close. They were not the light. They came to bear witness to the light and to say in their being that something more is here, more in us and more in the world. For John, the light was Jesus, the real flesh and blood Jesus. Too particular for some, too restrictive, too limiting, too local, too common. This leads to the worship of a dead hero if you make it too common. You can manipulate Jesus if you stop him 20 centuries ago and leave him there. But Christ flows like a river, always has, and the Christ has been stopped in history. Jesus has become a sitting duck these days to be used or abused, and in the writer of John's Gospel's mind, that is not good enough. The particularity of God, the idea that the Word becomes flesh and dwells among us, sets us all marching to a variety of responses of our own. I have a response to all this, a nice general response to Jesus out of which I live. I don't like the particularity when it turns to rabid evangelicalism. I hate rabid evangelicalism. It leads in my mind to intolerance of difference. It leads to elitism. It makes people smaller, not larger. I like to sit back and acknowledge the mystery. The Jesus story presented in the Gospels and wrestled with in daily life is lovely. It's enchanting and it's opaque, and I like to dream in it, and I like to write about it, and I like to be poetic about it. And there's a danger in that too, in that I can be lost in the theological fireworks and never engage real people in real pain on the street as Jesus of Nazareth did. Well, how are your feet? Which way are they leading you as you walk in the mystery of Christmas? John writes that the law came through Moses. That is, Judaism, our mother, gave us the great framework of life, the ethics and the engagement of human interaction and divine quest which we acknowledge today. This is the garden, the cradle, and the schoolroom of Jesus the particular. Grace, he says, has come through Jesus Christ, a living example of pain and glory on the streets, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity, wrote Charles Wesley in 1739. Your God reigns is a puzzle to be solved, given at Christmas and meant as a teaser and as a teacher all life long. Be careful of your feet. You're treading on invaluable and irreplaceable pieces of the mystery of God.